thank you for being here. We're recording. Everyone's really excited to get some time to speak with you and learn from you. This is Project Owl, so I kind of gave you a little bit of a brief synopsis on it, but this is an open source intelligence community where we kind of track a lot of things going on in the world. On this little stage here with you are a couple of our administrators and moderators that run the show. You've been a topic of conversation, obviously, a lot the past year because you are one of the leading experts on Russia, and your predictions have been pretty spot on, if not really spot on. So we're really excited to get some time with you. Thanks again for being here. Thanks for, you know, jumping on this after your trip too. And I'm sure you're very busy. I'm going to hand it over to Goose here, who's a big fan of yours. He's a big fan of your writing since this all began. He's going to kind of be our MC, but we'll all be on here. So again, thanks for being here.
Okay. Thanks for having me on. Just a quick question. So is this like public, what you're recording? And I mean, that is to say that this is on the record discussion or what? What do you do as a community?
I'd say, yeah, this is not Chatham House rules. This is we're gonna put it on our YouTube, probably on our Spotify. So don't disclose anything you wouldn't want. No breaking news for us. So yeah, no Chatham House rules.
Right. If I ask you a question that is a little bit too hard, A, hard for you to answer, or B, you cannot answer it, just go to the next one.
Okay. Yeah, not a problem.
Good question. Yeah, thank you for that.
Mm-hmm. All righty, and with that, I think we can get started. So hello, everyone. Welcome to Project Owl's Owl Talk with Michael Kaufman. He's the Director of Russian Studies at the Center for Naval Analysis and one of the most foremost experts on the ongoing Russo-Ukrainian War. In this talk, we're going to be discussing the role of analysis in OSINT during open conflict, specifically this war, and his thoughts on the current situation as a whole, as well as some questions for the audience. I go by Goose here. However, I am a student at Texas A&M University with the Bush School and a pilot, and I just got out of a really great talk and a lunch with retired Supreme Allied Commander in Europe, General Todd Walters, about an hour ago. He gave me some great insights in the current conflict that we may or may not have time to get to later. With that, I'll give it to Michael to give a bit more background on himself. And I know he just got back from a trip from Ukraine. So, Michael, I'd like to know what insights you gained from that, and then we'll get into some general questions.
Okay, well, a bit about myself. So, I've been working in military analysis for quite a bit. I worked previously a while ago at National Defense University, which is Department of Defense. I've been a fellow here and there. I'm principally kind of a person who sits at the intersection, I guess, of area study subfield, which is Russia, Eastern Europe area studies, with a subfield of kind of the Russian military, specializing in that, and also functional military analysis and to some extent defense planning and strategy. I'm originally from the Soviet Union, I'm originally from Ukraine, for those who don't know. And so I speak Russian pretty well, and I understand Ukrainian reasonably well. Yeah, and I was recently in Ukraine, which we talked about once we had actually left and just had gotten out of country. I think a couple of us commented on the fact we had been there for a military analysis field study trip. And also a bit of an exploratory trip to figure out what the benefit was, what you could see, what kind of things that you get access to on the ground, contacts you can build, and what have you. Okay. So with that in mind, I'm not really sure actually where to start off the conversation on insights. I'll be perfectly frank. I prefer to get questions as prompts rather than
just I have those.
Wander off into lecture. It's already 4 PM where I am, and my mind tends to wander at this point of the day. So I don't think you want me to just press the mic button and keep talking.
Gotcha. All right. I'll give you some props then. So as Kel stated, we here at Project Owl focused on open source intelligence. It's played a role in this conflict to an extent, and members of the server were even able to listen to Russian radio communications at the beginning of the war in a piece which appeared in the New York Times. But I'm going to get into a question from Nauer, who's one of our members here. And he asks, if you believe that Russia has made any significant effort to propagate solutions and fixes to their MSTBs, that being their material technical support brigades, during this conflict. And before you answer that, for the rest of this conversation, I'm going to try to avoid talking about WMD usage, even though that's a topic of rising interest and other questions that really you can't answer to a really clear extent.
All right. No, fine. Y'all can ask whatever you want. But okay, material technical support and this aspect of it. So early on, at the very beginning, when the invasion first began, it's very clear that they actually had almost nothing organized and sorted. They drove it administratively with rules of engagement to the extent of that they were going to largely help Ukrainians, quote unquote, liberate themselves. And that military was not sorted or prepared for war in a sense that they hadn't done the maintenance and sustainment. They had deployed combat service support and material support brigades along with the units of the military district. But across the board, I can actually talk for the next 20, 30 minutes of all the things that they didn't have prepared for scaling force employment for combat operations, right? After that, when they had attempted to reconstitute, they had already lost a sizable amount of equipment in the first month of the war and a decent amount of the force, like a significant percentage of the better component of the force. On the other hand, well, this is going to sound a bit perhaps cynical and cryptic, they had a lot less force to maintain after that first month. So the challenge I think they also had is that it was a very variegated force. A significant percentage of the initial invasion force involved mobilized personnel from LDNR and Rosguardia, which actually wasn't very well interoperable and had its own separate support base. Okay, and the longer the war has gone on, the more the Russian military had been dependent on LDNR and Rosguardia to an extent, and to a much, much lesser extent, Wagner troops. So it became much less of a cohesive military effort to begin with. Okay, that's not a clear-cut answer to the person's question. My basic view of it is that logistics over time became better sorted, and actually was a different story depending on which front you look at from the very beginning. I'm happy to take a follow-up on that.
Okay. Let's see. Now, by the way, Michael, we have a bunch of questions lined up in the Altalk section here. So now, if you want to ask a follow-up to that, you can type it out. We also do have some members of the Ukrainian military in here, so they might ask something. I'll ask the second question. It is no secret that this war has not gone to plan for the Russian military. Over time, Russian generals in charge of the so-called SMO have been replaced with new ones. What observable changes, if any, have been observed with Russian generals, different ones, who have taken command over this war?
Well, you know, a number of generals got relieved early on, principally for two different reasons. Some for cheating and lying about readiness, and the actual composition of the force they had available, and others for actual performance and force employment, fired for cause. And some were not fired, but should have been, but were just recently fired. For example, Lapin. Colonel General Lapin is a great case of somebody whose performance in his district performance was quite poor at the very outset, and maybe personal connections or preferences are a good way to explain why he's lasted so long. Okay. I have seen big differences in performance, not so much necessarily at the very top in terms of military leadership, because the challenges the Russian military had were principally structural in nature. They were also due to a big mismatch between political aims and military means available, right? And you couldn't just change leadership to reconcile pretty significant strategic problems in what the Russian military was trying to accomplish and how they were fighting the war. And they're also born of force structure, force design choices, and quality and level of training forces. And changing generals in that respect can be like changing deck chairs on the Titanic. You know, you can arrange it however you like. It's not gonna change the trajectory of the war effort. And the big issue was that those commanders that clearly wanted a more rationalized war effort were blocked at the top by political decision making, because it looked obvious that Moscow, basically Putin, in a number of cases would refuse to allow them to retreat or to withdraw to better defensible positions or to something that the force can manage. All right. So some generals, I think, are probably more competent than others. A good example of that might be Surovikin, who had typically spoken pretty frankly, had been arguing for quite some time, you know, despite his kind of well-known ruthless background and all these sort of things and rumors that swirl about him personally and his style of leadership. But yeah, I think he probably has been one of the people likely speaking truth to power throughout the course of this conflict. I would add that my own personal impression, right, and you take this for what you want, there's one honest opinion, that people like Valery Gerasimov were probably filtering information to the political leadership, and that's what eventually led, you likely read a lot of these reports over the last couple of months, that's eventually what may have led Putin to go around them to contact theater commanders directly to figure out what's going on the ground.
All righty. We have another question, and I'm prioritizing this one mainly because we have an individual in here. Did a lot of pre-war work in regards to identifying Ukrainian AA sites and assessing to what extent they are prepared for a Russian onslaught. And he mapped every single S-300 site in the Ukrainian military, and of course didn't disclose that information to public spaces. But this question asks, how do you assess Ukrainian air defenses going forwards? In particular, any thoughts on the remaining levels of Soviet-era SAMs, the distribution and organization of air defense units outside Kyiv and on the front lines, and the most likely employment of the limited number of Western systems that have been delivered?
Okay. That's a tough question. So here's what I think I can say, speak to that subject. First, I think Ukrainians have employed their air defense quite well and competently and successfully. I think it's actually a good demonstration that Soviet air defense really works, but it's highly operator dependent. And it's the kind of systems that don't have great kind of multifunctionality, but if the operator is very proficient in using the system, they can get a lot out of it in its designed role. And I think Ukrainians demonstrated that with systems like Buk-M1, for example, that were quite lethal in this conflict. I think also early on, they were pretty good at displacing some of the air defense, although most things that were fixed or not moved, I think a lot of them were struck by the initial Russian attack. So, you know, we can, you know, people want, we can discuss the efficacy of the early Russian strikes, but I think the Russian military was a lot less successful than they had expected, but they hit most fixed radar sites that they knew about. On current state, I suspect that Ukrainian air defenses are running low on ammunition. They're just a hunch. That's been the case across the board for a lot of Ukrainian capabilities. I suspect that Western air defense is going to make a significant difference in this regard, and it comes at an important time in the conflict. I also suspect that we're likely going to make the same mistake as we did with artillery and provide Ukraine with many different types of air defense systems and small numbers of each, all of which are not interoperable, have different types of munitions, different types of training requirements. So it's going to be, again, you know, Ukraine trying to operate a NASAMS and, you know, a Hawk and the IRST and who knows what else next to it moving forward. But that's a lot better than the alternative of not having it. So yep, that's my view on that subject. I just hope that in terms of Western provision of military assistance, we can move forward from the lessons learned over the course of summer and now do what we did by providing Ukraine with 14 different artillery system types.
Yeah. I'm going to try to venture out of incredibly specific technical questions and move on to a more broad category. In Kherson, the Russians have been stuck across the Dnieper fighting the Ukrainians for months. Their access to supply has been severely limited. Are you surprised that they are still holding on? Do you expect them to leave anytime soon, or do you expect them to fight tooth and nail for every inch until they cannot?
Sure. Am I surprised they're still holding on? No, not really. They had a high force density to terrain ratio there. They had some of the better troops, and they were able to find interesting ways basically to keep supplies going. A lot of those public discussions I saw of Russians are completely cut off now, they're totally out of ammo, all these things, just not true. Okay. That said, supply flow is quite constrained, and I do think that they're likely forced to ration ammunition on that front. And Ukraine has considerable advantages, both due to the geography, due to the correlation of forces, and the ability to resupply. Now, my sense of what the Russian military is trying to do, and this is, again, just my own guess at it, is that I think they are trying to actually conduct a staged retrograde operation where they want to withdraw on their own terms. I don't think they're going to abandon Kherson in a sense that they've decided they don't want it anymore and now they're just leaving. They are forcibly being pressed out. I suspect that the Russians see the writing on the wall and want to avoid an Izum or Liman type situation, and probably are actually reinforcing with mobilized personnel, which you would need to do if down the line you want to conduct a strategic withdrawal, to have stable defensible lines, slowly begin pulling out and extracting key forces enablers. And then the big question is, what do they then to do with Kherson City? My instinct tells me that they likely want to make this as costly a battle as possible, and they will want to be pressed out and will want to
inflict. Fight for it?
Sorry, can you say it again?
You'd think they'd fight within the city proper?
It depends on how Ukraine pursues the offensive, actually. Hate to tell you, it's kind of depends on how the offensive develops. So I think Ukrainians are likely optimistic in that they could take the right bank of Kherson by the end of the year. That's 2 months from now, so it's actually not a tremendous amount of time. I think that it depends on whether or not they are able to advance down the middle operational axis, which is the one that's kind of pushing past the Davidia Grid, and are able to bring artillery within range of the city of Kherson. And if they go for Novokakhovka first, if they go for the city first, I suspect then, and I don't think they're going to do that, expect to be a rather bloody fight. So yeah, unfortunately, it all depends on how the offensive develops.
So is there, I'm assuming that this is the case, the shortest route to the middle of Kherson is one highway that stretches just north west of the city, and it goes past that airfield, I believe it's Chernobyavka, and into the city of Kislyvka. Is there a reason why there hasn't been, from what I have seen, in an incredible amount of Ukrainian force structure being sent in that direction? Is it mainly because Russians have mined and defended the crap out of that area, or is it just because they want to focus on other areas of the front?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, from the very beginning, there was fighting, you know, around Posad-Pokrovsky, and like, it's a very short run. I was literally just in Mykolaiv and in parts of Kherson myself personally. It's a pretty short distance to the city. I will be honest, they've not had an easy time just trying to take, you know, Alexandrivka on the coast. And I think the short answer is that there's a high concentration of Russian forces that are pretty entrenched there. Even though clearly if you've seen satellite footage, which I'm sure you all have because you're
awesome community,
right? you've clearly observed that they pulled out of their their entrenchments in Chernobyavka, right? So they've withdrawn from it, probably anticipating a push, but it's not clear that they've actually withdrawn across the river. I honestly think that's not been where the main thrust of the offensive, where the offensive has been. I think the Ukrainians have tried to push very hard down the middle from the Davidia Grid, and the sort of river bridgehead that they have there, and as you've clearly seen from the northeast towards Luchani. And there's a bit of a bump out on Russian lines in between those two.
All right, yeah. I'm now going to ask a perhaps even broader question. I can narrow it down if you'd like. I'm curious as to how you see OSINT as a whole in this conflict, to what extent it's useful for both sides, as well as from your role as a military analyst, where it falls short and where it can improve and or evolve.
Okay. Well, you know, I mean, let me ask you a question back, and this is going to sound a little silly. What does OSINT mean to you as a community? Like, if you were to define yourself, how would you best do it?
From my role here, I and an individual who is able to aggregate information from a wide spectrum of sources and put it together so that way it can be easily understood. Now, those spectrum of sources are open source, Twitter, Telegram, et cetera, et cetera. The information that I get from there is limited in its classification, but could also give a very interesting picture. And there is a lot of it. But I think it can be misleading. But I also can think it, paint a very interesting picture.
I find OSINT very useful. I think that a lot of what there is to be known, a fair amount of it, does exist in open source. I'm a big fan of the people that do deep dives into narrow things, and whether they're good at IMINT or they're good at picking up signals and whatnot. I like this. To me, it's a very valuable resource, always has been, right? And a lot of what I think the bulk of what I do, I imagine.
Mike, you know, one thing I think that's funny is you probably saw Calibre Obscura, that Twitter account, put out a tweet the other day that said OSINT is more than just retweeting news wires, which I think that's something that we try to do here is, like you said, deep dives into narrow subjects. I think that's really where the power is, because we don't have a budget that we're worried about, right? We have the time that we can spend to do some of that sort of stuff. So,
sure, absolutely. And so I'm a big fan of it. I will tell you, to me, the military analysis community is fundamentally a community and a network. And it's lots of people talking to each other and working together, and many of them behind the scenes. I work with a lot of colleagues. I'm friends, I like to think, with most people in my community. And it's a big network. Okay. That's where I think it's great. Where I think there are challenges in this, first, there, Twitter and other type platforms give perverse incentives. Like it gives an incentive for you to try to author opinions on subjects early on and to offer hot takes. And those are usually wrong, just to be perfectly frank. The hot take factory, from my point of view, is almost always wrong. For a second, a lot of times folks opine on things where they don't have actually any professional experience and they haven't worked on those subjects, and they're not as frank about their confidence levels or the fact that they don't have all the sources, being honest. And it's a question of, you know, in the OSINT community, to what extent you're doing analysis versus you're kind of discovering and aggregating information, or you're discovering raw information. So that's my view of it. I like it all. I don't think that there's any clean separation between the field, although sometimes myself, I've been tempted to do gatekeeping, you know, and those are always my worst impulses. I think they are for everybody. Sometimes it's a love-hate relationship, because I see accounts with all caps OSINT, you know, in the title online, and they're authoring opinions. And I'm going to tell you something. They've never worked in any of these fields. I've never met them in a single discussion in my life. Not a there's lots of folks that offer their opinions, but on the internet, which is very accessible, And some of them are pretty good, but those are non-refereed views. And so my only view of it is that I really love when OSINT people do a deep dive into something that they're passionate about, that they spent a lot of time on. I'm much less sanguine of the OSINT people that are just putting an opinion out on everything that happened, you know, streaming through the day.
Very interesting take on that. I like that. All right. That does correlate with a lot of what we've seen. We have to blacklist a lot of accounts here that just have OSINT all caps in their name, and then they put out all caps a tweet that is usually taken out of context and very misleading and made for clicks. And that really complicates a lot of things.
Sure. Sure. And just, yeah. And just to add, sorry to interrupt you, just to add, there's lots of things initially that are kind of fake, or the imagery is not right, or the context isn't correct, and I see it. And I don't know if you follow me, but you'll notice I don't repost nearly as much of anything. I'm not nearly that active compared to other people online. But I generally try to make sure that anything I repost is something I believe to be true. And then if there's something going around that I've not commented or reposted on, just to be frank, that's typically a sign for me that I don't necessarily believe that to be true.
Hey, Mike, I have one question for you before we move on from that. Sure. How did you handle at the beginning of all of this, the kind of the scrutiny you were getting for, you were really sticking to your guns with your predictions and they came true, but there's a lot of flack, not against you, but just saying that people didn't believe that was what was going to happen. How did you kind of weather that at the beginning of all this?
Yeah, that's fair. And I did get a bunch of flack. I got it from some people who kind of thought I was warmongering. I got it from prediction markets who were annoyed at the differences with Eric Hall. And I got it from finance people who thought this was bad for the markets and investment. And I was one of the voices out there predicting war. And I will tell you very safely from my own experience, war is bad for a lot of folks, and it's not a prediction they're interested in hearing. And it's very hard to actually convince people that a war might be looming in the horizon. And that prediction is not very interesting, just to be frank. My best prediction I've always felt were all the times I predicted there wasn't going to be a Russian invasion before this war. Back, you remember the kind of annual Russian invasion scares, the Ukraine?
Yes.
You remember that. And I have to write multiple articles and pieces saying there's not going to be an invasion, or this is a case of coercive diplomacy. And it was only in two cases. November 2014, where I wrote a piece a while ago, I remember, for CNN, saying that there likely might be a winter offensive in the turn of that year. And it was this particular case, going back to, I think, end of October, early November, where I really started to believe that the war was likely. So how did I handle it? I mean, to be honest, I think privately, I was giving war a higher probability chance than publicly. And so were a number of my colleagues who were in this field. And, I don't know how best to answer that question. I just say that I have a firm belief that, one, you should try not to make too many predictions. Two, experts are usually bad at predictions, and you should recognize that. Actually, generalists tend to be a lot better at predictions, to be perfectly honest.
That's great.
Given both of those things are true, you know, if the facts and your interpretation of the facts leads you to a particular conclusion, and that is a fairly moderate to high confidence conclusion, then you should stick with your convictions. Yeah. And just be careful of confirmation bias, right? Just watch out for any evidence that comes along the way disputes kind of your initial position, and don't be dismissive of it. But if you're still confident down the line, which I was, if you read my January article on War on the Rocks, then you should stick to it. And the worst thing is you might be wrong. And as an analyst, you actually learn a lot more from being wrong than you do from being right, to be perfectly honest. Can I tell you something? Sometimes you are wrong. Papal infallibility is not the benchmark for this profession. And you're going to learn a lot more from it, and you should accept those moments if you happen to be wrong on something. I've been wrong on plenty, I'm sure, throughout this war. And don't let your position become something of a faith-based enterprise, you know, that you're so committed to. If the facts change, you should change with them. If the facts lend to a different interpretation, then that's what you should follow.
That's an awesome answer. Thank you for that.
I'd like to somewhat build on that. So I just got out of a conversation with Todd Walters, and I was talking to him about the American posture prior to the war. He was SACUR at the time. And most of Europe, and he was exercising his frustrations to me, just refused to believe that Russia was about to act in Ukraine. And he had been working, with tactics against flying against the Russian Air Force for a long time. He knew they were bad, but he had his ground commanders telling him that the Russian military was good and that they could achieve success in Ukraine immediately. And he had analysts telling him that they were going to invade. And so he had to work with what he got, and he had to bank on the fact that his analysts were correct, his ground commanders were correct, and he had to find some way to convince the general European governments that the Russians were going to invade. And that's what led him to have a whole bunch of different meetings with intelligence officials in Washington. That eventually led to a very, very controversial in DC, essentially just them telling everyone, hey, we have this intelligence, Russia's going to do this, which got a lot of flack. If they were wrong, then I completely agree with Kaufman. They're wrong. But he said that the decision to disclose all that intelligence information saved a lot of lives. And he would not have cared if it was wrong. Because on the one hand, A, you save lives, or B, you get embarrassed for a bit. So he's very glad that, that happened.
Can I speak a little bit briefly about predictions ahead of the war, just to be frank on something? And I'm going to be a little circumspect, and I speak about this because, you know, I was professionally involved in a number of these discussions. So first, because of the imperative of making the case that the war was likely, I think a lot of public discussions on what to anticipate for Russian military performance were not as well caveated. And that was because there was a strong case being made that this could happen, and Russia was planning a large-scale invasion of Ukraine, and to take the threat seriously, right? And it would have been a very muddled message to suggest that, yes, Russia's planning a large-scale invasion with maximalist war aims, but here's a whole spectrum of reasons for why they might not do so well, and so on and so forth, right? Just to be clear, defense establishments, and often political establishments, often don't do nuance very well. And especially if you're trying to engage in public or political message first. Second, assessments always come in ranges, right? So the notion that anybody out there said that Russia could do this in 3 days or that in 5 days or that in a week, it's actually not typically how analyst establishment works. That's not how analysts talk. If you've listened to me ever talk, you know that's not how I speak, right? I probably have a speech impediment in the sense that I often say things are contingent or indeterminate or they hinge on these factors. But I think you'd be surprised to hear me say that X is going to happen exactly in this number of days. And there's a reason for that. So there are two different things, at least, that go into your perception of the problem. There's your assessment of Russian military capability, Ukrainian military capability, and potential Russian performance. Capability is a significant factor that ties into your perception of what military performance is likely to be, but they're actually not the same thing. Military power requires a context to express itself. It's very heavily context-based, okay? So as I often say, how you might assess, for example, Chinese military performance in a war against the United States over Taiwan is gonna be very different than how you might assess Chinese military performance in a land war against India, right? Is that fair?
Yes.
Okay, very different scenarios, but you might have the same assessment of Chinese military capability, right? You might see Chinese military capability in the same way, you might rate it the same, but you're gonna come up with two very different performance evaluations because you have different contexts, different actors involved, different conditions, potentially different objectives and military strategies, right? Check. So just to be annoying, this is kind of complicated, right? And so you are trying to gauge capability of both sides, but most importantly, what that looks like in the context you're evaluating. And you have a lot of unknowns you're working with in trying to do that. And the bigger unknowns were actually on the Ukrainian side, not on the Russian side, in terms of Ukraine capability, Ukraine performance. And I will tell you that given that the Russian plan was very visibly to catch Ukraine cold, right? That is, conduct a snap invasion, do a bunch of thunder runs, kind of build something like an air bridge to the capital and get in there and affect regime change. I think actually a lot of the expectations might have scaled or hinged more on perceptions of Ukrainian military capability, and those were driven by two factors. I'm going to say this right now, and I think it's a conversation obviously for Ukrainians to have at some point down the line. It's not really a good conversation for me as somebody, you know, living in Washington D.C. to have, but they were driven perhaps by two factors. First, putting aside as much we don't know about the Ukrainian military, because people like me focus on adversaries, don't focus on allies and partners. But there was not good evidence of systematic Ukrainian military preparation for defense against an invasion of this type. There was considerable military preparation, I think, was done in secret, but wasn't very visible in public, and also certainly wasn't very visible to folks like me working on the subject. So that was question one. You know, to what extent was Ukraine really preparing to defend against an invasion of the scale? And second, it had to do with political will and resolve. And there, the signals were very mixed from the Zelensky administration, right up to the very beginning of the war. And it's very hard to gauge military preparation and political resolve when you're really lacking evidence on that front and you have a lot of mixed and contradictory signals, but you're increasingly getting very good outlines of what the adversary intends to do and the scope of their invasion plan. So I'm just saying this not to like say, you know, here are the reasons why we got wrong, but just to explain the complexity at the time and some of the uncertainty and the lack of information you're dealing with. And all of this will come out, I think, much more over time, right? The further we get away from the initial invasion point, the more will be known about who thought what and when.
All righty. I'm going to combine a user question and a very odd experience I had yesterday evening with a notable American political commentator whose name I will not name here. And it is in regards to the end of the world. And of course, this is a very broad topic, and I don't expect, you know, very clear, direct X, Y answer. But this individual stated that he does not expect Ukraine to fully retake Luhansk, Donetsk, or Crimea, because Putin is likely not to allow that, and that Biden is going to have to, at some point, dictate to Ukraine that they're going to have to accept this, and he's going to have to take flak for Ukraine not being able to go further into those areas. So first, do you think that's accurate, that they won't be able to go into those areas, and will Biden stop them? And C, this individual asks a question from my Ukrainian wife: what is your opinion on Crimea, and what is your opinion on the likelihood of the existing population there ever being brought back into Ukraine, if that's even possible?
Okay, so first question on prospects of Ukrainian military effort being going back into those areas. So my view is, first, there's really no good basis at this stage of saying what is Ukrainians can't or won't be able to do. A lot of those predictions have been proven wrong, and there's now two categories of people: those who have learned from those predictions being wrong and from the contingency and nature of warfare, and those who haven't. Right, and who continue to basically categorically say Ukraine won't be able to do X, Y, Z. And so my sense of it is that I think everything is possible. The question is, what is probable? And to be frank, it's a bit of a conversation on timelines. I definitely think that this war is likely going to stretch well into next year. I think that a good deal hinges on what comes of Russian mobilization and Ukrainian ability to conduct successful offensive operations next year. And part of that has to do with how the attrition fight develops over the course of the winter. I would say that a lot of that is also heavily dependent on external support, military assistance from the United States and other countries. And that has to do with material availability and policy, because, you know, in many respects, the long-term balance can favor Ukraine, but it's heavily dependent on external military assistance in terms of projections. So my short answer to that is no, I think that's wrong. I think a lot of things are militarily possible, and military outcomes are really driving political realities here in this war so far. There's a question on Crimea and return of population to Crimea. Don't know the answer to that one. I'll be honest. What I do for a living is, you know, as I say, military analysis is not predicting of fortunes necessarily. It's not fortune telling. So it's very hard to say, give an answer to something that specific. I think that probably if Ukraine is incredibly successful, if Ukraine is wildly successful and is able to take back everything to 2014 lines with the exception of Crimea, they could force Russia to some conversation, negotiation on Crimea, its status, and the right of IDPs to return and what have you. But this is all down the line conversation. I honestly think that a lot of these conversations right now are rather premature given where we are in the war.
Right. I'm going to ask a personal pilot question. I don't know to what extent you have, you're a military analyst, so you might be able to answer this. But I would like to know, because I haven't seen much analysis on this. What do aerial engagements look like in this conflict? And by aerial engagements, I mean, you know, MiG-25 versus a Russian Sukhoi. A lot of people expected far off BVR, beyond visual range engagements. Is this still the norm, or has there actually been a dogfight, as has been claimed by both the Russian MOD and the Ukrainian military, anywhere?
Okay. It's a thorny question. So I don't know. I think I think the air domain in general and aerial combat and to some extent the entire airspace dimension of this conflict is the one least accessible to OSINT, if I can put that politely. And a lot of things I've seen written I'm skeptical on. So my view of it is that I don't believe there's been much in the way of dogfighting in this war. I don't believe there's been a tremendous amount of air-to-air engagements. I think most engagements have been between aircraft and surface-to-air missiles. I think most aircraft have been operating just behind the forward line of troops. I won't make a comment as to who I think has had successful air-to-air engagements in this war. But I think the evidentiary basis for a lot of claims in air-to-air combat in this conflict isn't there. All right. I think a lot of this has been a bit of a complex air versus air defense fight. And Russians are notoriously not good at seed and deed and don't train and practice for it very well and have tried to adapt with small pocket type packages. But it's been very, very mixed in terms of outcomes for them. I think most of the interaction has been between the air defenses of the two sides and the aircraft. What else can I add to that? So, yeah, I'm not sure there's been a tremendous... If you're a pilot... And beyond visual range, air-to-air kills is what you're really interested in. I don't think you're going to walk away with too many cases from this war. My personal suspicion.
That's quite interesting. Okay. So outside of specific air defense, it's another question from Shumkateli, I believe. What capabilities, categories, and systems would be the best option, or and that's a definite, in your opinion, would be the best option for U.S. aid packages to increase Ukrainian combat effectiveness?
So on capabilities, I'd say probably protected mobility. Most transportation on the front is civilian, I have to tell you, and it's very hodgepodge, and there's a lot of volunteer logistics. And I think that Ukrainians could benefit from a lot of standardized protected mobility, first and foremost. I think that getting better distribution and logistics sorted might benefit them as well. It's one thing to provide supplies. It's another thing to actually have good distribution within a country. On specific mil capabilities, well, I think we all know air defense is one. Ammunition is a big factor. I think down the line, this is not for the United States, but I get a sense for why Ukrainians would want to switch to a Western tank system, because if the war runs long enough, then Soviet ammunition type can become a problem for armor as well. And yeah, you kind of see that there's a big shortage in the APCIV category and the light protected vehicle category as well. My mind is kind of sputtering right now, but I'm trying to think what else might be worth mentioning. And none of these things are particularly exciting, but I'm just telling you that these tend to have much greater effects. A lot really hinges on sustainability of sizable supplies of 155 ammunition and Gimlers for HIMARS.
Okay. Interesting. There's been a lot of talk about ATACMS. That I don't think I'm really going to get into, because that is, in my opinion, the Russian version of a Western WMD for Ukraine. So adding that, I think, would be very problematic for the spectrum of warfare, so I'm not going to ask about that. But
I'll say this. I think there's a reason why ATACMS is not being provided to Ukraine, and it's a political decision, and that's that. And I don't want to offend anyone here, but lots of folks can talk about it till the cows come home.
Yeah. Biden wrote a long piece about it that I would actually encourage people to read, because that's, I think I would agree with Kopp, and it's a political decision. And I don't think it would go down well if we gave them that. I'm going to ask you very quick questions here, and then I think we'll start wrapping this up. Sure. So, of course, in a war, both sides talk about the enemy's casualties. Ukrainian estimates of Russian casualties are, from a lot of perspectives, seemingly very high. Mm-hmm. And it's the same story for Russian estimates of Ukrainian casualties. Do you have any thoughts on either side's assessment? And could you maybe even provide your own assessment?
Okay, I think some assessments that are out there are way too high relative to the force composition and size that we've seen in this war, meaning they just don't look very realistic, no matter how you cut it. I've had written some threads about this early on. It's a bit strange. The casualty conversation is kind of part of the information war, and it's a little sensitive for reasons that conflict that's sort of I don't think that this is an issue that I don't think this is something that needs to be worked as part of the information campaign. So I will give this very unsatisfactory answer. I think that probably the publicly put out estimates by intel communities like US and I think Brits of 20 to 25,000 KIA, which is maybe, 2 months ago. So you could, based on the way they've been going, you could probably extrapolate towards, 30 KIA. I think that that's probably closer to the truth. I think that somewhere between a 3 to 4x multiplier on that and added together for total casualties is likely fair. So somewhere 100,000 of total casualties. Everybody, I often get this question. It doesn't include LDNR and doesn't include Wagner and doesn't include all these other auxiliaries like Rosguardia. And my answer to that is yes, it includes everyone. On the Ukrainian side, well, this is a bit of a thorny subject, so I will answer it this way. I think Ukrainian casualties are lower than Russian ones. I think that Ukraine likely has a higher ratio of wounded to those killed compared to the ones on the Russian side, and that's where the more significant asymmetry lies. However, I think the Ukrainian total casualties are quite substantial as well. That's my personal impression. And if you're asking me what am I going off of, I'm going off of a host of anecdotal evidence and kind of my own hunches and some time I've spent.
There's not a lot out there from what I've seen. There is an individual out there on Telegram or Twitter who does visual casualty count, but as opposed to outside of visual things, it's very hard to get information out of.
I've seen a lot of bad methodologies for doing it. I can tell you that much.
So. Yeah. Are you talking about the 1 to 3 casualty ratio thing or something else?
No. What I'm talking about is the people, for example, who are using Oryk's blog looking at vehicles destroyed and then imagining how many people might have been in them and multiplying that out. People that are doing aggregate OSA assessments on the basis of different estimates, such as Ukraine's public estimates, the Russian military's official estimates, U.S. intel, British intel, and doing this kind of like, hey, I'm going to average 5 different answers, 3 of which were wrong, to see what the middle is, right? This is not the way. You're just coming up with a 6 wrong answer, okay? Like, being very frank. That's what that methodology yields. Yeah. So,
all right. You just did return from Ukraine. If you could just give a very quick, brief estimate on what you'd say the attitude there is of the people. Is it still very patriotic and high? Do you see this continuing for months, if not years, to come?
Sure. So here's my impression. I think morale in Ukraine is very high. I think that the Ukrainian military is winning. They know they're winning. They have a really good sense of mission. I think they're quite serious about the fight. Parts of the area, some of the fronts are incredibly difficult, like Kherson. I mean, the lack of progress isn't for lack of trying, right? But the Ukrainian strategy is also about force preservation. And Ukraine is not throwing its troops away the way Russia did in the spring and early summer to an extent. I think that there is a soberness about the potential length, the sort of how long the war might run, because mobilization introduces some uncertainty. I think publicly, you know, there's a lot of natural fixation on everything that's terrible and shambolic about Russian mobilization efforts. But I think in general, this is viewed much more seriously as something that could extend the war by a considerable amount. I think that there's great optimism about what's going to happen in Kherson and possibly in northern Luhansk, but also a real appreciation that, hey, a lot of the war depends on sustainability. Large-scale conventional wars come down to attrition and replaceability of manpower and material and ammunition. That's what I always talk about, and the capacity to reconstitute.
Hey, Mike, I got one question for you.
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Got one question for you and then a wrap-up question. Sure. There's something that we've discussed on here quite a bit back and forth, just with some of the people who follow the war. And it's a feeling that we've seen observing the way Russia acts in the war that, you know, they're giving a lot to fighting Ukraine, but it seems like they're holding back something. And I'm not talking about nuclear. I'm saying more, you know, Georgia as an example in the past, right? Do you think that there's a reason Russia is holding back a bit? Do you think they are? Do you think they're putting everything that they possibly could, you know, into this?
Yeah. So, okay, here's my view. I don't think they're holding back. I think what happened is that they actually started mobilizing very, very late. Russia has considerable amount of latent military power in terms of what's in storage, the ability to refurbish it, put into the field, all the ammunition that could be refurbished, and from equipment to manpower. However, for reasons that, you know, we clearly don't have time to get into in this discussion, they got about mobilizing that very, very late into this war. In fact, fairly recently. And so it's not so much that they've held back, but they have very clearly, it's that they didn't want to make any of the political decisions that would be costly and would really commit the regime to the war, but also enact mobilization of wartime measures, which they now de facto have done. But this is all going to take many months to yield results. Like, you should be looking at a 3 to 4 month timeline, right? So your initial evaluations barely a month in are not the timeline you're looking at to see what Russia could get out of it. Now, is it going to dramatically change their fortunes or change the trajectory of the war? Not necessarily, but that's not the important point. The important point is to try to figure out what are the indicators you're looking for and the right timeline to look for them. If they're holding anything back, no. Actually, I think they're quite low, probably in reserves on a lot of their better capabilities. I think they've spent a good deal of the better part of their force. And I think that they likely spent millions of rounds in artillery ammunition, and there are challenges there as well. All that being said, there's considerable mobilization potential in that system. Mobilization is always going to be a very fitful process early on, and the question is this going to look any better at all down the line? But more importantly, look at the mobilization of equipment, economic mobilization, and mobilization of production of the key things they would need to sustain the war. So that's the way I tend to look at it, putting aside nuclear weapons and that whole conversation.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I don't think Russia's been holding back. I just think that folks like me thought that they were going to mobilize in April. That's when that would have been the most dangerous course of action. They had the force structure. They had the officers, the manpower. If they had done that, the trajectory of the war, well, they might have been a very different place come end of summer, beginning of September, but they hadn't, right, thankfully. Now, that being said, they have chosen to go through with it now, and you're actually not going to see many of the results or benefits of it for at least 3-4 months.
Interesting. Well, maybe we'll have you back in 3 to 4 months if you're amenable to it, see how it's all going.
Well, I mean, it could all be going much worse and no better for them, to be honest. Here's the other factor. Rather than mobilizing in the spring for summer offensive, they're mobilizing late fall in order to try to maintain what they have in the winter. That's not a good place to be because they're going to deploy a lot of guys in probably with not great equipment into the winter and bad weather conditions just to hold on to what they have.
Interesting. Well, hey, that was a great answer. Thank you very much. I know I want to be cognizant of your time. I really appreciate you being here. And I want to ask one last question that I'm going to read to you verbatim from a user because it's very nice. Okay. Michael, thank you for all the work you've done. You are an incredible inspiration to a lot of us. Do you have any career or life advice? It's from our user, Goliath.
I don't know if I have any life advice. But I'm not sure. Whenever you self-reflect on your own life, you're never sure whether that would be a great model where it provides you sufficient intellectual authority to give life advice, right? So, yeah, I'll just say I've done the best I can. On, you know, career professional advice, well, I have no idea what you want to do. What I will tell you is that, to me, if you want to pursue something like a strategy, it's always about choices. If it comes to career, I always recommend finding the intersection of something you love doing with something you're actually good at doing. And ideally, something somebody will pay you to do. Right. That always helps. So that's my Venn diagram advice for you. You know, and beyond that, it all kind of depends. A lot of it's also, to be honest, here's career advice. You end up having a bunch of different careers and having to reinvent yourself over the course of your professional career. So these could run any number of years, but be adaptable and and then figure out who you need to be in different parts of your careers. So at one point you're making it as an analyst, and another point you're a senior analyst and you're in the conversation. And if you're a thought leader in the field, you should really look into mentorship and how you're trying to shape the field. You no longer need to prove to anybody in the room that you know what you're talking about, right? That phase is over for you, right? And then how do you enable other people? How do you bring other experts along? And then you start thinking about younger generations of analysts and what the field looks like and what are the important conversations in your field. That's kind of, I think, a bit more where I am. I'm much less focused on kind of being the voice in the room, which may sound weird, right? Because I have Twitter followers and all that. But, you know, I joined Twitter late during COVID. Honestly, if it wasn't for COVID, I might not have even joined Twitter, to be perfectly honest with you.
Well, thank you very much, Michael. We really appreciate your time here. Hopefully one day you're able to come back. We really appreciate your analysis, and you do a really great job.
Yeah, Mike, right. we'll be putting this on a podcast and a YouTube, and I'll send that to you when we're done. And really appreciate you being here. Thank you so much.
Sure. Thanks for having me on. It was a great conversation.
All right. Have a good one.
All right. Take care, everyone.